Having a weak bladder is nothing to be ashamed of. And I'm here to tell you, there is help. Jude supplements are natural, backed by science and approved by doctors. They were co-created with real women and are clinically proven to reduce leaks by 79%. Jude supplements contain a blend of pumpkin seed extract and soy germ extract, two very simple yet highly effective natural ingredients. Are you ready to start your 12-week course? Go to www.wearejude.com and you can receive 10% off with the code THEHAPPYVAGINA10. That's www.wearejude.com. Welcome to The Happy Vagina, a podcast dedicated to celebrating pioneers in the female space who made a difference in women's health, equality, and relationships. Each week, we chat to an inspiring human being as they explore the experiences that completely changed their outlook, promising not only to educate, but also to entertain and enlighten. And this week on The Happy Vagina podcast, we are joined in no particular order by actress, mother, political activist, award-winning singer-songwriter and platinum album-selling Paloma Faith. Paloma, welcome to the Happy Vagina podcast.
Thank you. Hi.
Hello. Welcome, welcome. Paloma, you've been on my hit list since I started the podcast 2 years ago, and I invited you to come on, like, on the first season, because I'd found out that you were making this amazing documentary about motherhood, and it almost happened, and then it didn't, and I'm so thrilled that actually it's happening today, because so much has happened in your life in that period of time that I feel like we've got so many topics to discuss today. But before we get onto them, I am going to start with our completely binary fun quiz, Desert Island Vaginas. Is that okay with you?
Yes.
Okay, great. How are you feeling today?
I'm all right. I'm always a bit flustered because I've got this weird thing that I think that I'm a superhero and I can stretch time and I actually can't. But
I do think that with time, sometimes I think a minute feels like an hour and an hour feels like a minute. And so it's quite difficult for me also to work out how much I can get done in an hour, because sometimes I can get loads done in an hour.
Yeah. And sometimes you're useless in an hour.
Absolutely useless. Yeah. Well, we're really grateful for you joining us. And as I just said, we are going to start with Desert Island Vaginas. And this is just an either or quick quiz to get us into the vagina mood.
Okay.
Question one, brief or G-string?
Brief.
Always? Has it always been like
100%.
That?
Even the image of the chafing of the G-string and the rubbing is like making me feel some sort of way.
I'm literally like so shocked by this, Paloma, because the jumpsuits that you wear on stage, are you wearing a brief under that or are you commando?
I'm usually wearing a Novi PL brief.
And I do know about you that as you were grafting your way to where you are today, ongoingly grafting, you used to dance at the, I'm going to say the Torture Garden, but it's not the Torture, was it the Torture Garden?
Torture Garden was, when you were, yeah, but not dance. I did cabaret shows at that, yeah.
And when you were doing those shows, you were still wearing a big pant?
Always a big pant.
Not a G-string.
But it wasn't, my shows weren't sexy, they were really weird, so it's sort of irrelevant about my underwear because I was covered in either head to toe in hair or some sort of prosthetic. I don't know. My stuff was more performance art.
With performance art. And now when you're on set doing Pennyworth, which is your latest, you know, major acting role, are you wearing a brief rather than a G-string?
I'm always wearing a brief, Nika. I've never not been wearing a brief.
I'm literally, because I absolutely thought that you were going to say G-string. I'm like trying to work out whether or not actually I'm right and you're wrong. Next question, tampon or menstrual cup?
Neither. I'm still old school 90s sanitary towels.
Are you?
Yeah.
And have you gone kind of quite organic and
yeah,
sort of
like
eco? Because I know it's one of your major things.
Yeah, all cotton, like biodegradable vibes. But I don't like tampons. And I'll tell you why, because my flow is so unpredictable that if you try and pull it out and it's not been that full on, it can really hurt. So I just avoid that. So I just like do sanitary towels. I actually use the ones that are postpartum ones, because they're for some reason like more cottony and more biodegradable.
And you haven't got into the ones that you can like reuse, the washing out ones at all? It's quite big at the moment, isn't it?
No, I'm not that great.
I can't do that either. I've got a bit of it. I'm into periods, but I've got a thing about blood. Okay, next question. Clitoral or G-spot?
I think I've had more success with the clitoris. It's harder to find the G-spot, but I mean, it's great. I don't even know if I ever found it. Maybe I have. Who knows? But I like both.
Yeah, both would be great.
At the same time. Yeah.
Yes, yes. Blended orgasms. Me too. Mm-hmm. Morning or nighttime sex? With yourself or with a partner? When is it? Well, I'm really interested in when your libido comes through.
My libido is 3 or 4 p.m.
Ah.
But obviously I've got 2 children and 5 careers, so it's very unlikely that I get that.
Just for people that don't know you, can you just let everybody know what the 5 careers are?
Well, music, acting, I'm writing a book, doing an interiors range called Paloma Home, that is, and I've got a collection of buggies. But I'm always on the lookout for more things. So
one of the things that drives me absolutely nuts is, because like you, I have a kind of multifaceted portfolio of a career. And quite often people say to me, you know, are you doing too much? Or do you want to concentrate on one thing? Or
what would you choose? Which is your favourite? That's an annoying question.
Recently, I was on a date with someone and he said, what's your backup plan? And I was like,
I'm in it. I'm doing my backup plan times 4 and the original plan.
Are you my dad? All right, dad. No, I haven't got one. This is it. But and it really drives me nuts because I put money on it that no one ever said that to Will Smith when he was doing The Fresh Prince of Bel-Air and then said he was always doing music and then wanted to go and do that. It's definitely a bit of misogyny in it, I think. Anyway, final question for you. Truth or beauty?
Oh.
And it's a desert island vagina question, so you can only take one of them.
Well, my first album was called Do You Want the Truth or Something Beautiful? And I think beauty.
That's interesting. Really interesting, especially because I'd say one of the things that's been a conversation for you within your career is that you, what it felt like was that at a stage in your career when you wanted more truth, your label or your management team were kind of like moving you. This is your musical career, just to make sure everyone's on the same page as us. They were trying to move you away from, let's say, being more political into something more commercial, which potentially could sit in the beauty camp. Or does it? Does truth sit in the beauty camp?
I think both. But when I said that, I meant sort of like, I tend to feel like, for me, the story is the most important thing. So I tried to live my life like that. So I tried to make every day kind of exciting, even if it's mundane. So like, I'm not too worried about fact. The reason why I say beauty is because like my mum's always berating me. She's always like, that wasn't right. You told that person in that interview this thing. And it's like, and she's like, you embellish the truth. And it's like, yeah, but the story's the most important thing. Isn't the story more entertaining, more dreamy? Like, who cares? And who knows what's truth and what's beauty anyway? So I answered it from that perspective, I guess, more of an existential perspective than like a literal, you know. I think if it was literal, I'd probably say truth. But I would say that, like, in an existential way, I really believe that, like, I want to, you know, I don't want to like die and my life story be just loads of really harsh facts. I'd like it to be a bit mad and a bit of a magic carpet ride.
And I mean, it certainly is. Your mum, you just mentioned, who potentially occasionally berates you for not being honest enough. Also, in your fantastic documentary, which don't believe is live at the moment, but that doesn't mean it won't be when this goes out. We will put a link in the notes underneath the podcast. It was with the BBC, but in it, you read texts that your mum sends you, which are, so, you know, your mother is one of your biggest fans, isn't she?
Yeah, but not for the reason that other people would think. So she's not that proud of like commercial success or for my forward facingness, but if that's a word, but she is, you know, she's a big fan, or I guess I'm not, I don't know about fan. I reckon most, I don't know, biggest project. She's constantly, you know, like on me trying to advise and trying to like be part of my decision making. I actually just interviewed her this morning for my own book. It was interesting because I've not really, I think when you're old, when you get into sort of later life, you don't necessarily just sit and ask your mum direct questions anymore. You sort of bustle about each other. But I did for my book, and I found it really enlightening and interesting about how she viewed me. I asked her stuff for the book about, you know, what her biggest anxieties were and stuff, what she thought. And the most of it was all just, yeah, it's like interesting because I think she's not necessarily proud. She says that in the documentary, but I think she's just always worried.
Our parents do worry, don't they? I mean, it is good that you've done that. I think one of the things that in the piece of work that I'm writing at the moment is I'm doing lists of questions that I would have asked my mum. And so I think it's really beautiful. And regardless of whether or not you're writing a book like you are, you know, people listening, if your mum, you know, if you're 15, perhaps you don't want to do that quite yet. But I think as you get older, I would recommend every single human being ask their parents the questions that they would probably like to ask them. And I am just writing a book at the moment myself, and I'm having to make up the answers that my mum would tell me, which is kind of fun and actually potentially more, you know, it's good for me to be able to make up all the nice things that she'd say. You are, you know, you've already touched on how hard you work, your multiple careers. You're a grafter. Would you call yourself a hustler?
Definitely. My nickname used to be the Bosher, because even before I had a career, I've never really believed that I understood the word no, which I think is kind of a blessing and a curse. But if someone says no, I'm just like, that's not a no, that's not a definitive no. It just means that I've got to try a different way.
And one of the things that we're going to come to talk about, which you're so vocal about, is motherhood. But your mum and dad were both around. They separated when you were quite young, but you were raised an only child. There were lots of cousins around. Do you ever feel like being an only child has impacted that hustle that you've got? Like, do you think that kind of needing to do things on your own when you were little then gave you that kind of chutzpah, that thinking, that like, how do I do this on my own to make it happen?
Yeah, I do think so. I think really what it did was, because I was an only child to a very hardworking mum, career obsessed mum, I had a lot of time where I just had to occupy myself, and I had loads of extracurricular activities because that was how she managed for childcare. Yeah, I would say like I'm used to being very busy, and I'm used to being self-sufficient in terms of like how to occupy my time. I was raised to believe that boredom is the modern word. So I've never been bored. I don't get bored. If I do, it's very brief and I take responsibility for that. I just do something to make it not that. And that's across the board. Like if I'm in a situation where, you know, the conversation's rubbish, I just start saying really sensationalist stuff to make it a bit weird. Just find the entertainment somehow.
To rock the boat. Would you describe yourself as an anarchist?
Not really, with a small A, maybe.
I mean, some of your colleagues have described you as being, you know, the hardest working person they've ever worked with. In your documentary, it starts before the pandemic, and then towards the end of it, or whatever order you shot it in, it's about your experience and you you talk about somehow or other really seeing very clearly that your happiness or your confidence perhaps was quite dependent on the affirmation that as performers we get back from a crowd. Since that point, has that changed? Like, so there's this moment where it felt like you were, that you knew it, but you were feeling it. Like, you've always known that. We know that as performers. We know that there's a deal that's being done in terms of our esteem being not propped up, but supported by this. I actually think it's a kind of a sort of a divine output. You know, we're also like expending ourselves and sharing our creative juices with people, and then they affirm it. So it's not, I don't think it's necessarily just a kind of like crass, oh, I get my ego's boosted. But since that point, when you realized that, have you done work on it to kind of like try and work out how to unpick it and untangle it? Or have you just gone back to work and to get more? Let's just get back on the road.
Well, I did do that. I did go back on the road and I did find it like exhilarating and amazing. And I think the first time going on tour back after the pandemic, which isn't in the documentary, I think that I did have like a little bit of a breakdown because I was so exhilarated. I was so like satiated that I fell into it in this. It was very intoxicating and I found that very emotionally distracting because of obviously not doing it for so long. And I realised that I'm an addict to it and that feeling. But I've recently started a form of therapy that's really interesting called CAT therapy, cognitive analytic therapy. And I haven't completed it yet. It's only 16 weeks. Or it can be up to 24, but generally it's 16 weeks. And that's quite in depth. And what a lot of that's about is like your relationship with yourself. So it's about being validated by your inner self, which I'm not very good at. I think that I'm naturally prone to being quite hard on myself. And I guess I wrote a song the other day called I Am Enough. And I don't really, when I sing it, I don't really think it's true, but I'm trying to convince myself. But I think that's the work that I need to do, that I'm in the process of focusing on, because CAT therapy is generally about relationships, and the one that you naturally overlook when people talk about relationships is the one with yourself. You kind of think, oh, I'm doing loads of work on relationships, and then the therapist was like, yeah, but what about the one you have with you? And I was like,
well, we don't think of it as a relationship.
No, but
it's kind of just there.
Yeah,
it is.
It's actually probably the most important one you'll ever have in your life. So that's sort of difficult to come to terms with, though, if you're used to not thinking that way.
We're going to take a short break. Before we do, I just want to let you know that this podcast is produced by the female-founded production company, Pineapple Audio Production. Pineapple create groundbreaking podcasts from concept through to your headphones at the very highest level of audio. Their international team support independent podcasts like mine, The Happy Vagina, as well as major brands like the BBC and Grazia. And they are super passionate about helping young people into the audio industry. To find out more, go to pineappleaudioproduction.com or check them out on Instagram at pineappleaudioproduction. Say goodbye to intimate skin irritations and discomfort with Oomph by Quana. Oomph by Quana is the UK's first all-natural, water-based lubricant that is enriched with CBD and prebiotics designed to enhance blood flow and pleasure while maintaining a healthy vaginal microflora. Oomph sets itself apart from the rest with its gynecologist-developed formula made right here in the UK. It's pH balanced, free from harmful ingredients, and loved by customers who have reported fewer infections and irritations compared to using conventional lubricants. Try Oomph today and feel the difference for yourself. Visit their website, www.byquana.com, and use our code, thehappyvagina20, to get 20% off. That's www.byquana.com. But some of the things that we've just been talking about, I think I mean, I watched the Barbra Streisand documentary and she was saying that she totally micromanages her career. Like, just everything about it is like under her complete control. And I think that's actually quite a good thing. And again, coming back to the sort of male female question, men and women, not something that men would be berated for, but women are often somehow judged or called controlling, right? Like, it's like they're in charge, whereas when we do it, we're being really controlling. But within your career and everything that we've just talked about, do you find it possible or easy to let other people in to it and actually kind of, what's that process like for you? Like letting, and I'm not really talking about, because I know you do collab in terms of like writing songs, but do you trust anyone else, Paloma, with your creative output?
I don't. And I do have a quite close collaborator, creative director called Theo Adams, who I've known for a long time, that I've only recently started working with. And that's the closest to that I've ever come, because I think it's to do with the fact that a lot of our influences are similar. So that's the first time. And actually, that was good because I started working with them and I'd had my second child and I wasn't able to be as present. Because I was like, one of the videos was shot when I was like, had my cesarean booked and stuff like that. So it was like really great that I found them at that time. But I think that's important in my job anyway, because I think that when we talk about, you know, music careers with longevity, the people who sort of last are those that are obviously authentic. And I think you don't get that authenticity unless you're really, you know, hands-on across the board with everything, because then it just looks like a marketing strategy and that people can smell from a mile off. So I think that it's actually not a bad thing that I micromanage everything. I think people can tell that it's very much from me. And I think that's why I've had a longer-term career than a lot of people.
It comes out of you, doesn't it? I would completely agree with that. It's that your brand, for want of a better word, and I don't mean it in the commercial kind of marketed way. I mean literally your output all reflects exactly who you are. And you are, I mean, also the other thing that I really love about you is that you are brutally honest about things in your work. In a world where quite a lot of the time people with public profiles are somehow watching what they say or being told to watch what they say or thinking about it. And part of your brand, I'd say, is that you wear your heart on your sleeve, Paloma. I mean, you're just, and what's really beautiful about it is that it goes with you. So it's not like, well, I said that, so I've got to stick to it. We kind of go through your journey with you in your life while you change your mind about things, but you don't have a filter. I mean, you don't, I would say you don't have a filter on things. Would you agree with that?
I'd say that I do have a filter, but I just don't have the same inhibitions as most people. So my filter's just different to most people's. But it's not, I just feel a little bit more accepting of stuff, I think, than most people. I think once people get to like the bit, I have unusual things that make hairs on the back of my neck stick up, but I'm quite uninhibited, I think. I think one of the things that I love most about all creative outputs is that, and what I'm interested in, I think, as an artist or as with acting or music, is like, I'm really into the human condition. A massive bit of the human condition is the fallibility of the human condition. So I think it's okay to have a really strong opinion on Monday and have a different one on Thursday. I think most people feel like they have to be defined by what they put out or what they say, and I don't. I just think, well, I don't need to be defined by that. I can be defined by something different another day, because we're all changeable, and experience and timing and whether you're hungry or tired affects the way you view things. There are like huge things that you go through, life-changing events, and there's small things like whether you've had a sandwich or not. But I don't think that matters. And I think that, that's why I don't really like that type of journalism where they come out and say, so-and-so said this, but we found when they said the opposite 6 years ago. It's like, what? Loads happens in 6 years. Like, no one's allowed to, that's sort of like a really counterintuitive way of thinking. I think, you know, like, does that mean no one can ever repent their sins? No one can ever change for the better, progress, further themselves, access parts of themselves that were dormant or whatever? So I just don't really believe in that. I think it's very restrictive.
And you've mentioned so much in that, but significantly as well, age. Like, we get to grow up and change the way that we feel about the world and our relationship with the world and those around us. And you actually, you know, you've been described as having your children late. You have said that you had your children late, you know, and you've just mentioned that now that you, congratulations, you've had your two children. I don't know if you want to have more, but that was one of the things that you were fighting for in the industry, that you said that it's really difficult having children in the music industry. And I would say that struggle that you went through definitely impacted me in the fact that I'm actually a child-free woman, because I couldn't work out how I'd make it work. And you fought for those things that you wanted. But sadly, you know, for many female musicians, a pregnancy announcement can actually can sometimes mean a cancellation of their career. I mean, I think it was in 2016 that they said 77% of women said that they were discriminated against. I'm sure it's even more than that now. And in the entertainment industry, where we've got contracts that are actually cancelable within a split second, there's very little loyalty, you know. And in the interviews, when you talked about it, you talked about the industry being very male dominated, which I think, is it 97% of producers are male? Is that still true?
It's 6% of commercial music, I think, authored by women. I know that much, but I don't know exactly what the facts are. You have to cross check that.
Yeah. In 2021, I remember a report coming out that said that 97% of music producers were men. So when you came to have your children within the music industry, did you feel frightened that you would lose your career?
Yeah, but I think that goes across the board for most women in most careers, even ones that you'd think lent themselves to that. I think, you know, women who have babies who are teachers or whatever worry. I think that's unfortunately something that, it's a two-pronged thing. So it's like, how are you going to be treated, but also how are you going to feel, because you don't know. And so, yes, I do think, and I have noticed a difference, you know, like the way that people speak in a commercial way about how to, like, how can you turn this life-changing thing into making it marketable? How can we make this thing lucrative? And it sort of negates the fact that, why should you even have to think like that? Why can't you just carry on doing what you've always done? And why do you have to now figure out an angle to make that as appealing or to sustain a career? I find it really bizarre, which leads me to the fact that I do genuinely think that there's no female success has ever occurred without it being sort of like intertwined with patriarchal structures or ideas, like having to like move and shift according to remain in an inherently patriarchal system is like by default what happens to women who have children. And I do think the difference is tangible, like being, you know, a singer of two, my audience changed. You know, I am really celebrated by women, but I also find as an actor, I'm always getting scripts that are like to play the role of a pregnant woman or a mother. And it's like, actually, even though I've aged in years, I actually probably look a bit younger today than I did maybe 8 years ago when I wasn't getting cast in those roles. But it's just that people can't get it out of their head. They're just like, right, mother, who have we got? Who can we cast as a mother? It's got to be someone. Let's forget the fact that you're an actor, aka you're pretending to be someone else. Like, I could, you know, like, I don't understand why you can't cast a non-mother as a mother. Why can't you cast a woman whose mother is like a sort of, I don't know, prostitute, whatever, I don't know, but you don't.
I know, but even more to the point, when they're casting male roles, and when a male actor becomes a dad, they don't start thinking, let's cast him as a dad. Can you imagine? I mean, there'd be no babies in the world. The men would be like, fuck that. I'm not doing that. I don't know why we put up with it, to be honest with you, Paloma. But you did say that becoming a mum made you even more ambitious. Is that still true today? Because I think that was after your first. Do you still feel like that today?
Yeah, well, I feel more ambitious. I feel more efficient because I also feel like I'm, you know, I've got two daughters and both of them will be watching, and I think it's good for them to see their mum go for it and like have a career that she's passionate about. I do feel like I became more efficient. So what I'm able to do in smaller time frame, or I can switch on and off much quicker than I used to be able to. Like, I used to be a bit more whimsical. Now I'm just like, switch it on, switch it off. I'm writing 2 hours. That's what I've got, you know, all of that. So, yes.
It's forced boundaries.
Yeah, exactly.
It's forced boundaries on you. So you're one of the things that we have in common is that both of our mothers were feminist. And we recently found out that we were both on, like, you know, demonstrations and stuff as children, which at times I found it, if I'm honest, I mean, I wouldn't have it any other way, but I think I did find it quite overwhelming as a child because I was actually quite shy and it didn't really give me the opportunity to be me, you know, somehow or other. I'm not knocking it, but it was a weird thing. And so therefore, for a while, I rebelled against it. You've just expressed feeling a kind of a deep responsibility to your daughters. And I can really hear in your voice that it's important that this is about the female lineage as well, the daughters that are coming through. Have you ever, in your career and in your life, have you ever rebelled against not engaged politically with your work, with your ambition? Has there ever been a moment when you're like, actually, I don't want to be that? Or has it always been like that for you?
No, I've always felt responsible, but only with success. So as soon as I became public facing, I've always been very aware. I know it's the zeitgeist now, but, you know, everything's all about inclusivity and representation and all of that. But I've been doing that since the beginning because I just think that as a public facing person, you have an opportunity. You have to, you know, like if everyone collectively takes responsibility for planting seeds of change, no one's got to do anything massively big. So I always remember, like, you know, having music videos, and there's been several occasions where I've asked to see the cast list and it's just been like a pure white cast list, and I've said, no, not doing that, that's not me. And I would just do that, and that was 2008, so like before, you know, that became a thing. And then I walked on set once for a music video that was for a feature I'd done, so it wasn't mine. So I just had to come and be there, and it was the artist that I'd featured on video, and it was a room full of women in bikinis and roller skates. And I just turned around and walked out and was like, I'm not doing it. I'm just not doing this. And then they were like, why? And I was like, because do you know me? Like, I can't condone this. Anyway, they were like, we've lost the featured artist. Everyone was flapping around. I was like, well, we're in Miami. Let's just take to the streets and like go and find people in the street. And like, we ended up making a really good video with loads of people in the street. But I was like, I'm not going to stand in a crowd scene with a load of scantily clad women who are just there because sex sells. I just won't do it. So, yes, I've done a lot of that. I've always felt a responsibility. I've never shirked it. I also read scripts like that as well, I'd always be vocal. I'd say to a writer or director if I felt that something was amiss, unless it was like important for the character or whatever, to be perpetuating those ideas. Also, I've been told quite a lot as a woman that when I do a fight scene, I do it like a male actor, but I find that weird. Like, I remember doing a fight scene for Pennyworth. Some of the choreography felt a bit girly for me. Like, you pull her hair, and then and I'll be like, no, I'm going to headbutt her.
The anarchist with a small A.
Yeah. I'll be like, I'm going to smash her head into the wall. And they're just like, but you take the frying pan. But I was like, I'm not picking up a frying pan.
I mean, in some ways that's helping them along, but walking off a set for political purposes because you're not comfortable with women being exposed for the sake of them being exposed, do you ever think, because I do, so I'm sharing my failings, but, or maybe it's because I've been accused of it, but this thing about being difficult, you know, do you ever think, I can't say that because I'm going to be thought of as difficult? I hear you that you don't act on it, but do you get frightened of it, Paloma? Because I get frightened of it.
No, but the reason why is because I think that I've had to, and I speak, but I'm writing about this in my book, I think I've had to develop a way to communicate that is non-threatening. And I think a lot of marginalised communities do that and have been forced to do that because of preconceived ideas. So I think that, you know, it happens in, you know, when people are discriminated against because of the colour of their skin, that people are like, oh, they're a bit uptight automatically. And I think with women it happens the same, like, she's difficult because she's got an opinion, and this stuff happens all the time. So I think, unfortunately, I have figured out and developed a way to do it that seems non-confrontational. So when I describe the story, I would say, oh, I'm not going to do it. Because I've got this sense of humour that's really set me in good stead, I think that I've developed a way to soften these things in a way that mean that I don't really get branded as difficult. And that's something that I've done consciously. I've figured out a language to articulate and get what I want without cementing people's preconceived ideas about me as a woman.
Can you give, for the listeners who may have struggled with this within their own workplace or in their family or friendship environments, can you give us an example of a language that you would use? Like, or is it just that you say it with such kind of chutzpah and joie de vivre that it's funny, as you said, that it's kind of like, it's like, that's outrageous, I'm so not going to do that. And you just sort of, like, you know, like, so that it's so blunt in a way.
I think sometimes I would go for that, like, oh my God, what are you doing? Oh my, like, can we talk about this? And I would sort of say stuff like, my mum will kill me. You know, like, so people would just think it's sort of playful and a bit childish. I can't do that, my mum will kill me, she's a feminist. You know, like that. But it doesn't seem so intense.
I'm so visual. I just had this, like, literally my brain just had this image of a woman at Goldman Sachs with a man trying to make her have sex in the boardroom and her saying, I can't
my mum will
that.
Kill me, she's a feminist.
I think I might struggle as my mum's not here anymore, but I might just start using it anyway.
Well, you could say, my mum will turn in her grave. Which is a good
yeah,
one.
Exactly. So we have kind of sort of moved on to talking about your the acting part of your career.
Yay, what's wrong? Sorry. Normally
it's all right. It's actually really perfect timing for my next question. I can't begin to tell you. It's like, no, but this is the thing. This is what so much of your life's work is about. Is that trying to do this? Hello.
We can't put her in the picture though, but we can have her voice.
She can be on the audio. Yeah, for sure. That's fine. But actually, Paloma, this is really good timing.
And okay. And I'm. Tell me.
Well, it's just that I got the sense that, of course, you've always been an actress. You know, you've been doing drama since you were a kid, but it felt like you made a conscious decision for your mental health and your lifestyle and your income to rev up the acting so that you could have a more balanced life? Would you agree with that? That's kind of one of the choices that you made?
100%. I feel like because of the acting world, like being so collaborative. What have you got to say about it? Because it's been so collaborative, it didn't feel like everything's resting on me if I did some acting. Because, you know, like, off, do what off? Yeah, it felt like, you know, when you do an acting job, you get sort of 3 days in, and then sometimes you get these days where you're booked, but you're not in. That's quite brilliant for a parent, because then you're like, I've got these amazing days that I didn't plan for. Whereas in music, everything's scheduled so much that they don't allow, there isn't much time off. So with acting, they might say, oh, you've got, you know, 6 weeks, but you're blocked. And then you don't necessarily go in for all of those days. So that gives you time with your children. And also, like, the schedule where you start before they wake up, but then you get back before they go to bed, is like really nice.
Yeah. So has it had, because one of the things that you have talked about is in when you were traveling and away from your daughter and you had postnatal depression, which I think you didn't quite realize at the time.
Yeah.
You were brave. I feel like it's so brave. You did admit that you'd had, during that period of postnatal depression, some suicidal ideation. And would you say that you feel more rooted and grounded today as a woman? Do you feel like you've got a bit more control over your career in a weird way? Obviously, when you're a headline musical artist and pop star and rock star, you're in complete control. But do you actually feel like you've got more control over your life now?
I didn't ever feel suicidal, by the way. I just felt very low and lost.
You say it in the documentary. But that's what's amazing about you. That's one of my favourite things about you.
I do feel like when you talk about control, as in control as anyone can be, perhaps, because I definitely feel that I haven't put all of my eggs in one basket. And I think for a bit, when you first have children, or your first child, or if you have twins or whatever, you kind of like feel like, oh my God, this is the end of something. But also, it's also the beginning of something. And it's the same as any life-changing event, you know, like losing your mother or whatever, you know, divorce, menopause.
In terms of adding to your career, we're running out of time, which I'm so sad about. But in terms of your career, for people that are listening today, I mean, you know, as I've touched on, you've and, you know, people can go and read about it, but you have been pretty multifaceted since you very started expressing yourself as a performer from when you were a child. You've always done lots of different things. Do you have any kind of advice or suggestions for people listening that are doing one thing and might want to maneuver into another, and how to overcome the fears that they might have or the thoughts in their head that make them feel like they can't? Or how would you unstuck yourself? What is your process of unsticking yourself?
Well, when you look at, when you've got to a point in life where you've had some level of experience, you often get to the point where sometimes things don't work, but then those things that don't work then lead to something else. It's like a football game. People pass the ball. What? Your foot's got water on it. Sorry. So like a football game, you pass the ball and not everything's... I think if you think in those terms of success and failure all the time, and it's very black and white thinking, then that's too scary. And so I think for me, like, nothing was ever achieved without great risks. If you look through your idols, or you look through any great moment in history that you admire, or any great person you've looked at achieve something, they didn't do it without risking anything. And I think that it's actually the risk itself that creates any kind of success. And that doesn't mean that it will that success will manifest in a way that you can like preconceive. I think there have been lots of times in my life where I mean, for example, I didn't plan to be a pop star. I just didn't. I didn't plan to be a musician. I just did some stuff because I thought, oh, let's have a go. And it was risky. But I felt like, what have I got to lose, really? Like, I think a lot of these fears that we have are part of a construct of an idea of what success and failure actually means. When you rid yourself of those things, and then you sort of don't ever really not achieve anything. Because if I think about the great losses of my life, or the great failures, or the rejections, because there have been so many rejections, it's unreal. I think, oh, those led me to this. Like, you know, even if in the romantic sense that works, like, you know, you think all of these heartaches or moments of my life where I felt that I lost out on a great affair. And it's like, well, maybe one day you meet someone that it's great with, but it's not what you expected.
I mean, it's like, it's essentially that society or social constructs force us to think we need to lock things down in order to feel safe. But like you said at the beginning of the podcast, that you kind of don't really hear no. I think that the point that you've made is exceptional, that essentially we are forced into thinking about failure and success in quite a binary way. And if you look at someone like Kate Blanchett, all we hear about are the movies that are huge successes. She's got other movies that just don't actually function, that you just don't ever hear about, you know? And so no matter what your career is, whether you are somebody with a public profile like yours, or whether or not you're working as a primary school teacher, it's like, it doesn't matter. Just stop thinking within those patriarchal, binary, linear terms of where, and then it would explode. And it's funny because when I was thinking about interviewing yesterday, I was like, Paloma's just one of those people that just does it. So if I said to you, you can't do that, your response would be, why not? Why can't I? Who says I can't do it? Paloma, it's been such an honour chatting to
so
you.
So nice to speak to you.
Last question. What makes your vagina happy today?
Caniston.
And on that note, I'm going to let you go to your 3 million careers. Go and entertain the world. Thank you so much, Paloma Faith. It's been a pleasure. That was Paloma Faith. I'm Mika Simmons. This is the Happy Vagina Podcast. Thank you so much for listening. We will see you next week. And don't forget to like, subscribe, rate and review. It helps others to find us. And follow us on social media @The Happy Vagina.